You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Chickity check, check, cherished chummy champions. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 78, and of course, I am your humble host, Karen, and we are your gregarious, grungy group grasping for gripping granules.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris.
And guess what, guys? It's time for our usual correction segment.
Hooray!
Actually,
yeah, Chris, you got a actually.
I got an actually. Time to suck it up and admit defeat. Listener Tom D wrote us a comment and pointed out a very astute observation. I, in our show about temperatures, referred to degrees on the Kelvin scale. Because Kelvin is another way of measuring temperatures. The Kelvin scale, the unit of measurement, is called a Kelvin. It is not a degree Kelvin like on the other scales. So it is one Kelvin, two Kelvins, three Kelvins, which would be super cold. Just like the cold ice burn delivered by Tom D. But I deserved it.
You got served.
And it's a really, really important point because that'll probably come up on a trivia contest at some point. Like, what is the unit of measurement called? It is a Kelvin.
Now let's jump into our first usual general trivia segment, Pop Quiz Hotshot.
It's me again, because
it's you again.
That is because, again, on a previous episode, we discovered, hidden in a flea market here in Berkeley, California, a brand new copy of Jeopardy, the board game from the 1960s.
Brand new in the 60s. Yeah.
Brand new in the 60s. We popped the shrink wrap open, and as it turns out, a lot of these Jeopardy category questions, we would not be able to answer them today. I picked out two more categories out of 60s Jeopardy that I think we should be able to handle.
Yeah, usually we just, for Pop Quiz Hot Shot, I just pick a random current Trivial Pursuit card.
Indeed.
Yeah. Which has a range of like pop culture and sports, but this is all 1960.
I think that we should do fine.
All day,
it's just
every
that
day.
Some of these questions, they may not... They might not want to pose these questions anymore on Jeopardy.
Just
the way that they're phrased.
Time travel is part of
or
it.
Or the ways that the categories are phrased.
That's because a different
time. The first category is the Mysterious East. The exotic.
Right. Yeah, they probably wouldn't say that.
Yeah, probably not.
It's funny, it's mysterious, but most of the world's population is there. So,
people in the United States in the 1960s.
Yeah.
For $100. The country which Marco Polo called Cathay.
Oh.
Karen.
What is China?
What is China, yes. Animal used in Malaya to help harvest teak wood.
Huh.
Like Malaysia?
Maybe.
What is a water buffalo?
No.
Oh.
Guessing.
Karen? Dana?
What is a yak?
Not a yak.
Oh, I was going to guess what is a yak. Can you read Malaya?
Malaya. It is an elephant.
Okay.
Japan,
okay.
Sumo is one form of this sport.
Oh.
Colin.
What is wrestling?
Indeed. China fought an 1839 war in an attempt to stop the import of this product. Karen.
What is opium?
What is opium? Yes. $500 question. Japanese word for yes. Karen.
Height.
What is height?
What is?
Spelled H-I.
Sorry, what is height?
In the
oh, really?
Questions.
Oh.
Yes, what is high?
Should be H-I.
Yeah.
Oh. Hi.
Hi. Our double Jeopardy category is mythology.
Okay.
Well, at least that hasn't changed much since the 60s.
That is correct. Yes,
still cool to say mythology.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, now that we all read comic books, it should be, in fact, a lot easier.
Oh, okay. That's true.
Isis and Osiris were deities to these people. Colin?
Who are the Egyptians?
Yes. Yeah. Who were the Egyptians?
Who are the ancient Egyptians?
Yeah. Because, of course, there are no Egyptians anymore, according to this book.
It says,
who were the Egyptians?
Who are the ancient Egyptians?
Substance of wings which melted when Icarus flew too close to the sun. Dana.
What is wax?
What is wax?
What's his dad name? It's Icarus and...
Daedalus,
right?
Is that right?
Yeah. Yep. Great Hall in Asgard, wherein Odin received souls of heroes.
Great Hall.
The Great Hall in Asgard.
So is that, what is Valhalla?
What is Valhalla?
Thor.
Eurydice's boyfriend.
Oh, what's
Blank
his name?
And Eurydice.
Yes, yeah. It's,
I don't know.
Wait. Doesn't begin with an O.
What is
it? It's.
He's not Lawrence Fishburne's character from The Matrix.
No, but it. Orpheus.
Orpheus. Yes. Finally, the $1,000 question. Disappointed in love, she faded away till only her voice remained.
Oh.
Karen.
Echo. What is Echo?
Who is Echo?
Although she was a nymph, so maybe she's a what and not a who.
I am very lax with my Jeopardy. And so, yes, I will accept that.
Yay!
Hooray! 60s Jeopardy.
Good job, brains. So we get a lot of questions about our podcast and...
Like, what's wrong with you?
Why are you guys so ugly? So I figured I'd share some from email, from Facebook, from Twitter, and we'll share a couple of these. First off, someone asked, how do you decide who does what bit?
It's kind of just whoever grabs something.
Yeah.
You stake your claim on whatever you want to talk about.
Not a lot of people know this, but what we do is we set up a topic, which is really general. You know, like a couple of weeks ago was on hot things, and that can be interpreted as, you know, chili pepper hot, or it can be heat and temperature. Mm-hmm. And so it's a pretty broad topic. And then all of us find something within that topic to research about.
Well, we've given each other an idea of what we're doing, but we also try to not let on too much about what it is we're talking about.
Because we're cheaters and we would research it so we can answer the question. So we try to be mysterious.
It's just about, trust, or in this case, not trusting you.
And sometimes we show up on day of recording not knowing at all who's doing what.
Right.
Before the show, we'll kind of be like, well, I'm talking about something like this. Last week, for numbers, Colin's like, I got a music quiz, and it's going to be number music quiz. So I'm already thinking, like, what numbers are
trying to be very circumspect in how I put it down, because I don't want you to show up having already sort of, you know, not like cheating, but accidentally brainstormed.
Right. Researching the answers to it.
We can't surprise each other either, totally, because we will both show up having researched the same thing if we don't.
You know. All four of us did Bombardier Beatles. So what do we do now?
Lastly, we have a question from Jonathan Barnett and Emily Murdoch, and they asked us, what did you guys study in school?
What did I study in school?
That was a long time ago.
Japanese. I majored in Japanese.
Are you fluent? 100%
No, I wouldn't say so.
Dana, what did you study?
So for undergrad, I did sociology, and I did social research for a while, and then I was like, I want to do something different. So I took a bunch of night school classes and engineering, and I thought about being an engineer for a while, computer programmer. And then I took a Flash game making class, and I was like, oh, I want to make games. And so I went back to school and I got a degree in learning design and technology. Now I'm a game designer. That's what I do.
I studied psychology and art history. That was just kind of just based on what interested me. And I don't necessarily know that I applied either one of those in my day-to-day working life. You know, the art a little bit. Art and design definitely goes into it.
I went to architecture school, like for architects to become an architect. And I got out. I was like, you know what? I like playing video games. So I'm not going to do architecture anymore. And this week, we're actually going to talk about school. It is September. Many of you already started your first day of school, your first week of school. And we thought we'd dedicate this episode to weird, interesting, fun facts. So, class is in session. When I wake up in the morning and the alarm gets out of warning, I don't think I'll ever make it on time. And I give myself a look, I'm at the corner just in time to see the bus fly by. It's alright, cause I'm safe by the bell.
All right, guys, time for a quiz. Take out a sheet of paper and your number 2 pencils.
What's that?
Will pins work?
What is this paper and pencil you speak of?
I don't think I've used a pencil I don't think I've handwritten something in a really long time. I don't remember what my handwriting looks like.
I type everything. Mm-hmm. Even in school, I hated writing everything. But we did. A lot of the things, it had to be paper and pencil. The classic yellow number 2, often a Dixon Ticonderoga.
Oh, yeah.
pencil. Yeah. At least in America, it is seemingly ubiquitous.
With the crappy erasers that kind of just fall out.
The little pink erasers, So there is so much just great, you know, kind of nerdy trivia wrapped up in this one object of the yellow number two pencil with the pencil lead and the eraser on the thing. So let's just unpack this a little bit. So right off the bat, let's just get this out of the way. So why is it number two?
I don't know.
When you said, Karen, I thought for sure. I was like, all right, out of the three of the guys. So what is a number two pencil? What does it refer to?
It's a measure of the softness of the graphite or the hardness of the graphite.
Oh,
yeah. Right.
Like H2.
So Karen, the reason I thought you might know the number one is, so as Chris, you're absolutely right. The one through four are sort of the standard. There's a one, a two, a 2.5, a three, and a four.
Are they all yellow?
Well, so we'll get to that in a minute. Okay. We'll get to that in a minute. So this is just about the lead or the graphite, actually, on the inside. So the one are the really soft ones. And so, like, at either end of the extreme, they kind of tend to be specialized. So ones are really popular with artists and people who do a lot of drawing because they're really soft, smooth lead. It kind of spreads easily.
Oh, yeah.
But it wears down really quickly because it's so soft.
Right.
So at the other end of the extreme, you get into your threes and your fours. It's a really hard lead. It predicts a really kind of a light line.
But it
lasts longer.
So it's like the H scale and the B scale in drafting and drawing pencils.
Yeah,
you have a B1, B2, H1,
A2. Mm-hmm. A lot of the rest of the world, Europe and Asia in particular, use the HB scale.
Ah.
Right, where H is for hard, meaning like the fours, or the really rigid, and then the B is for black.
Why does America have to have a weird measurement standard
for everything?
Well, you know what? Actually, the 1 through 4 measure, the numbering system came from Europe. It came into America and then sort of fell out of favor in Europe. I remember, you know, one of the first little bits of like, trivia, fun, I learned as a kid is like, you know, it's not lead in the pencil, it's graphite, you know, even though we call it pencil lead. Uh-huh. And they did actually used to use lead for writing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You
go like back to PB lead.
Yes, like actual lead.
Yep.
Yeah. What a bunch of dummies.
When did they stop using lead?
People started
probably
dying.
Right about when
they didn't stop using lead in pencils until around the 1500s. And this is a great story. They discovered graphite. All of it, they didn't really know what graphite was.
They were just walking down the street one day.
There is a story that goes that in England, in Cumberland, England, a gigantic tree uprooted. This is sometime in the 1500s. And attached to the roots of the tree and exposed by the roots of the tree were just these big globs of this dark, you know, heavy substance that people found really made good lines, really marked really well. They called it black lead.
Oh, okay.
Or plumbago. Plumbago. And like
that
plumbago.
It sounds like a delicious fruit, doesn't it?
Like plumbago?
Yeah.
Think of like a Winnebago, but shaped like a giant plum on wheels.
Yeah, plumbago meant like lead deposit. And they thought that this was another type of lead.
I don't even know what graphite.
Graphite is carbon. It's a
it's like charcoal, right? It's like burned up wood or something, right?
It's not burned up, but it's just a different form of carbon. The way like diamond is one form of carbon.
Okay.
Graphite is another form of carbon. Right. Just depend on how how it's arranged. The name graphite didn't come along until 1789, actually. So for hundreds of years, they just called it black lead or plumbago, right? And graphite means writing stone because it was sort of named afterward. Like, this stone that we use for writing, let's give it a name. Mm-hmm. And it was coined by a guy who was basically trying to say, no, I don't think this is actually lead. I think it's something different. I think it's its own material.
But people still called it pencil lead after hundreds of years.
Yeah.
Just stuck. It's still called pencil lead.
Yeah.
I remember, this is a dumb story. I remember when I was a little kid, like if you got a cut and with the pencil, you're just messing around with the pencil and things happen and you got stabbed in the pencil. You're like, I'm gonna get lead poisoning.
Yes.
But graphite, this was a huge deal. I mean, and it basically from the discovery of graphite, for the next 100 years, the best pencils came from the best graphite. And if you controlled the world's graphite supply, you were just the... Not surprisingly, the English for a long time were just, all the best pencils come from Cumberland graphite, you know? And it was... They didn't really know where the great deposits of it were.
Because nobody had been looking for it.
No one had been looking for it. They didn't even know it was a separate substance at first, right? England and France, they go to war occasionally. You know, if you know your history, you know they've been at war many, many, many times. So during one of the many wars between England and France, there was a blockade. And one of the things that the English were like, no, France, you can't have any of our awesome Cumberland graphite.
Pencil?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So
they blocked them. Yeah. They pencil blocked the French.
Yeah. They did. But, you know, like many other inventions, necessity drives great inventions. So a man named Nicholas Conte. Conte.
I'm drawing pencils.
Yes,
art supplies.
One of my favorite, just as very quickly, one of my favorite bits of looking into the history of pencils is all the big names that we know today are the big names. Yeah,
today.
Conte, Faber yes! Castell, Staedtler. These are all
Staedtler.
Of the Dixon. These are all the original big names. Right.
I like
pencils.
So nobody.
You're so excited about office supplies. You're like,
nobody
oh
has
God.
Really disrupted the pencil industry in the manner. There's been no Steve Jobs of pencils. Lately,
pencil impresarios ruling everything.
So he was forced to come up with, he couldn't have access to high quality graphite. And so what he came up with is really what is we still use today is the modern graphite making process for pencil leads, which is you take powdered graphite and it doesn't matter if it's high quality because what he did is he mixed it with water and clay into kind of like a paste or a slurry and then extruded it into really long strips.
I love extruded slurries.
Fired them. Fired them in a kiln, so they were, you know,
hardened
and more durable. And this became just a breakthrough in the world of pencil making. It was a very top secret process.
And this is still not in a wooden canister like a pencil. This is just stick.
They were at this point encasing them in wood in a few different ways. The basic process today is still pretty similar. Is you have two slats of wood, you lay a piece down the middle, you put another slat on top, and you glue them together. And
they're glued together. It's not one tube.
Have you ever broken a pencil?
Oh, it's
You see a seam on it. You can see the seam.
Top.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought they took a really long drill and
drill holes individually.
In each dowel.
Well, that was an early procedure for doing it. Making pencils was tedious. All right. Now.
This is about to get serious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why are pencils yellow?
Yes! That's my question!
Why are they yellow? All right. Mm. So, like so many other things we've talked about before, it's just a great marketing ploy that was successful and everyone copied. In 1889, at the World Fair in Paris.
Always the World Fair.
The Koh-i-Noor Hartmouth pencil debuted. And now, remember I said that, you know, wherever the best graphite came from was the best pencils. So at this time, it was kind of like, oh, the best graphite is Chinese. It's the best graphite comes from there. And so they
mysterious east.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exotic east.
So that was part of the marketing of the Koh-i-Noor pencil. And it was billed as the top finest, best pencil in the world you can buy.
So
and it was pricey,
it
and they painted it yellow. Oh. There's a little dispute, actually, over exactly why yellow. But for whatever reason, they picked yellow.
Huh.
And the story went that customers were like, I want the yellow pencil. Forgive me that yellow one. And so that became the de facto color for high-class, high-quality pencils. Huh. And that continues today, at least in the States.
All
right. Wow, a lot of history in that one little thing.
It is amazing.
China, huh?
Mysterious seas.
Okay, I can't wait anymore. I gotta share this with you guys. So one of the things before I went to college, you know, I hear about the freshman 15. And of course, you guys know what I'm talking about, right?
Right.
This is a very common term.
Right.
Freshman 15 is the, quote, phenomenon where...
the unexplained mystery.
Where kids go to college in the freshman year and they would gain 15 pounds. Mm-hmm. I'm actually interested if there are other sayings around the world that they call it something else. But in America, we call it freshman 15. Where does it come from and is it true? It is not true. It is a myth.
It is a big old myth. Oh.
Now, is it not true, like, it doesn't happen at all, or it's not true, it's not really 15 pounds?
Okay, so there's yes for both. The Ohio State University did a study. On average, women and men probably gain around 3 pounds, but less than 10% of the freshmen actually gains 15 or more.
Okay.
I mean, there are a lot of factors, right? There could be because... You're not having solid meals. You're stressed out from school.
Your parents are not like watching you eat anymore. You're not eating with your parents. You can eat whenever you want.
My partying and drinking.
You're drinking a lot more than you used to in high school.
But you're also coming out of your teenage years. You're coming out of puberty.
Right.
Hormones, your metabolism is slowing down a little bit.
Maybe you used to be an athlete in high school and you're not playing on sports teams anymore.
Or vice versa. Like, and actually, 25%, a whole quarter of students actually lost weight.
I lost weight because I had to walk everywhere.
Uh-huh. But where did it come from? Where did the saying come from? It came from a 1989 issue of Seventeen magazine. And on the cover, right on the cover, the headline is Fighting the Freshman 15.
It's just that recent?
1989.
No, they call it the Freshman 15 because it's alliterative.
Yeah, it is. Because Fighting Freshman 15. Fighting the Freshman 5 doesn't sound as big a draw. It doesn't sound as bad.
Yeah, exactly. That sounds like a group of outlaws on campus, the Freshman 5.
Holy crap, 15 pounds. And it just basically kind of caused panic.
I would have guessed it was like 50 years old, that saying.
Mm-mm. 1989, first written, first appeared, 17 magazine.
Interesting. All right, I have a quiz for you guys.
Great.
It is about famous people who used to be teachers. People who are famous not for being a teacher, but who were a teacher at some point in their career.
Okay. I'm starting to think of some already.
All right. Let's see if they're on the list. He taught school for a few years before going to law school, and he was also the second president of the United States.
John Adams.
Yes, John Adams. And you know what?
It's like, which one? There's two.
This is what he said about the kids in his class, why he decided to go to law school and not be a teacher anymore. He called them... There's a large number of little rentlings just capable of lisping ABC and troubling the master is how he talked about his students.
So, not a lot of empathy
it's
there.
It's good he moved on to
I know, maybe they should have gotten him out of pre-K.
This former elementary school music teacher composed the album Come On, Come On in the wake of her breakup from Owen Wilson.
Owen Wilson?
Yes, the actor.
Who dated Owen Wilson?
Who had an album Come On, Come On?
Man.
I do not.
I don't know. I don't know. Sheryl Crow?
Sheryl Crow.
Oh, no way.
Good job.
Amazing. Good job,
Brittany. He was a high school principal at the Mexican-American Wellhausen School in Cotilla, Texas. He was also the 36th president of the United States and tied with Lincoln as the tallest president at 6'4".
Oh, gosh.
Who was a tall dude?
36. Is that Lyndon Johnson?
Yes.
Oh,
you got it for 36.
I was thinking later period I could figure out. Yeah, okay. I can just count backwards.
Well, that's not fair because Abraham Lincoln wore a top hat, so it makes him, you know, your perception of him is so much taller.
He is 6'4" without the hat.
In the wild, that is the Lincoln's natural defense technique, is to make itself look bigger.
Yeah. Puma attack.
Yeah.
This musician was teaching math in Connecticut when Bridge Over Troubled Water reached the top of the charts.
Is it Art Garfunkel?
Yes. He was a math teacher.
He looks like a math teacher.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, you're right.
He totally does.
Yeah.
Hey, kids.
He
sits on a chair backwards. Yeah.
Mr. Garfunkel.
Yeah. Just call me Mr. Art. But I'm not your art teacher. I'm your math teacher.
What a fully realized vision. That's amazing. Just with like tweed jacket and the curly Jewish hair. Afro.
Yeah. And he comes with his acoustic guitar.
And here's to you, Mrs. Algebra.
I think all of us had that
Yeah.
That was the opening scene for the Chris Kohler Art Garfunkel biopic.
This author and former school teacher was inspired to write Lord of the Flies after allowing a classroom of boys to debate freely.
Whoa!
William Golding?
Yes, sir. Okay. William Golding.
I can see that. And
right.
He's just standing there like, this is chaotic.
Yeah. They're so cruel to each other. Yeah.
Then the first one dies.
He's like, I'm gonna write
should
a book.
I stop? Should I stop them or start writing?
Like, that's just boys being boys. I don't know.
Human nature.
Right. Last one. Who taught speech at the Boston School for Deaf Mutes and is also well known for creating a communication device we use today?
A communication device.
He talks.
Alexander Graham Bell?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
He taught speech at the school, and he married a student from there.
Ooh.
When she turned 19. She was 19.
But that means they met before.
And of course, not that actually anyone uses a telephone anymore.
Oh, you're right. He didn't admit texting. I'm sorry.
He did admit Snapchat.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
So as we record this podcast, we're very close to Silicon Valley, the Northern California hub of many of the technology companies. But did you know that in the 1950s and 1960s in America, one of the absolute hotbeds of computer technology companies was Minnesota?
What?
Yes. Huh. Minnesota. Minneapolis, Minnesota was like, If things had gone slightly differently, we could be referring to that as like Silicon Valley. IBM, Cray, Honeywell, all the old, you know, the big computer companies, they all had branch offices and such. They were all doing a lot of research in Minnesota. Weird, right? We might all be living in Minnesota right now with the video game industry.
I might have never been born.
I always confuse Silicon Valley and Silicone.
No.
Value.
What's Silicone Valley?
Like,
I think that's down in LA.
Yeah. that's for something
that's the
else.
Other valley.
Silicon Valley.
Yeah. You know, I was growing up, I always mixed up the two. I thought it was the same thing.
I think if you just spend a few minutes on Google, you'll see that it still gets mixed up quite a bit.
Okay. Right,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
So the state of Minnesota, the government of Minnesota, of course, realized a lot of what was going on, and they were actually a very early proponent of computers in education and sunk a lot of resources into getting computers into their schools.
The government
like, into
did.
The Minnesota government did into, you know, universities and like mainframe computers and stuff like that. But even really early proponents of getting computers into like primary school and high schools and middle schools, stuff like that within the state of Minnesota. In the early 1970s, they were getting a lot of mainframe computers up and running that the schools could access. And so what they did that was really like forward thinking and really interesting was that various state governmental organizations in the state of Minnesota came together in our early 70s to create the Minnesota Educational Computing Consortium, or MECC.
I know that.
You've heard of that acronym, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you why you know it. So, like, when they started up in the early 70s, they had hired, one of their first hires was a young college graduate named Don Rowich. And while he had been a student teacher a couple of years before, still getting his degree in Minnesota and, like, going to schools, he was having trouble teaching some classes of kids history. And so he had actually, with a couple of his fellow student teachers, started working on a board game that would teach the kids about the Western expansion of the United States. People going from, you know, the East Coast and traveling in covered wagons and such to the West Coast. These guys had been, you know, at their universities, like, using the early computers. Mm-hmm. And so they did out this board game, and they were like, wait a minute, we could do this as a computer game. They called it first Oregon, and eventually named it Oregon Trail.
Yay! Yeah.
So And when you buy Oregon, when you used to go and buy copies of Oregon Trail in stores, it was published by the MECC, the Minnesota Educational Computing Consortium. So Oregon Trail, the game now is often, it's a video game that is, that school kids still play. They've got versions on Facebook and, you know,
and on iOS.
Then
too.
On iOS. Yeah. And you can play, even adults like to play it now. And basically it is it's a very early simulation video game. You start as a family of people who want to move from the eastern United States and like forge a new life in the frontier of the West in the 1800s. And mm-hmm. so it tells you who you are. Are you a farmer? Are you a banker? Are you a doctor or whatever? And that determines kind of how much money you have. And you have to buy supplies and you go out on the trail. Bad things happen to you because it's the wilderness and people get bit by snakes and people get dysentery.
They die of it.
They
sometimes.
Die of dysentery. Sometimes your purpose. Family dies. Yeah. But the whole point was it was to give, you know, kids an idea of like, you know, a
rough.
Very interactive idea of like, this is what it was like and this is what you had to do. The first rudimentary version of this was created on what was known as a time-sharing computer. Mm. They did not have personal computers in the early 1970s. I mean, basically, this was not something that people had access to. Not a lot of people had access to computers in general. So the way that a lot of these computers worked back in the day was through time-sharing. Mm. You had a computer terminal, which you used to interact with this computer. But then many, many people all sat in front of terminals. And there was only one computer. There was no monitor. It was a teletype machine. So there was a roll of paper. I mean, imagine a typewriter, basically, but you type something on the typewriter, and then the typewriter typed back right. at you on the next line of paper what happened.
Just one line at a time.
So yeah. It's like, you know, go west, and then the computer spits back at you, okay, I just went west. But, like, it's on a piece of paper that's getting rolled through this machine. And so when you were done playing the game, you had a whole paper printout of the whole game that you had just played. And so that's how they played Oregon Trail. The only thing that was really, really remarkably different than the versions we play now, I mean, there were no graphics, but... to go hunting, because there's segments in which you go hunting in Oregon Trail, and it's actually like a little action game. You go out and find animals and you shoot them. Mm-hmm. In this one, it just says, okay, you're hunting, and you have to type bang with an exclamation point. And if you type it fast enough, remember that not a lot of students were like good touch typers back in those days. If you typed it fast enough, it was like, great shot. You got 100 pounds of food.
Oh.
And if you didn't type it fast enough, it was like, you missed.
That's a good game right now. That's a good mechanic.
As the 70s draw on, the MECC realizes, oh, personal computers are the big thing now. Like,
right,
we need to start getting actual, like, you know, self-contained personal computers into schools. So they take bids from the big personal computer makers. And surprising everybody, the one they end up going with is the young upstart named Apple.
Mm-hmm.
And the Apple II. They did not go with an established name. Like, Apple just submitted a low bid, and they were like, yeah, we'll go with these guys. So the state of Minnesota places a huge order for the Apple II computer. So Don Rowitz, so then he gets hired by the MECC, and they're like, we need programs. It's like, oh, well, I've got Oregon.
Mm.
And the state of Minnesota, and these guys start programming, including Oregon Trail, which is the version that I first played when I was a kid. It looks like an
Apple
II.
Yeah.
But I didn't live in Minnesota. Like, I lived in Connecticut.
I lived in California.
You lived in California, and your school probably had a lot of Apple IIs with Oregon Trail, right?
Yeah.
Reason for that is because of what happened in Minnesota, because the MECC bought all these Apple IIs. They got all these Apple II programs. They'd create all their own Apple II educational programs and send them for free to the schools in Minnesota. Other states were like, hey, can we have some of those?
And it's like they were a turnkey solution already.
Yeah, right. So they were like, yeah, well, I mean, all our programs are for Apple. So the states were like, okay, great. Well, we'll buy a bunch of Apple IIs, and then you guys license us all this pieces of software. Other states would pay Minnesota, and then Minnesota would send them video games. The MECC, eventually, they spun it off as its own private company because it was doing so well it didn't need state funding anymore. And then it was bought by The Learning Company. Which is
Carmen San Diego,
which is now owned by Houghton Mifflin, Harcourt, I think it's called, the book
the
company.
Publisher.
Yeah, and so both the same company owns.
I remember Number Munchers.
Yeah.
The MECC, I mean, they just cranked out a lot of educational games, and for a long time it was part of the government of Minnesota.
Very cool. Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, they found a test in Salina, Kansas, from 1895
Whoa.
That people gave to eighth graders.
Oh, okay.
And I have looked at this test, and it is, it's tricky. Like,
well, eighth grade at that time was like graduating.
Yeah, you have like a wife and kids. Yeah. And
you weren't far away from your midlife crisis.
Off to law school,
So I pulled some questions from it, and I'll ask you guys, and we'll see how we do. Yeah.
Are you smarter than a 1895
eighth grader?
Probably
no.
Probably not. No. Give the 9 rules for the use of capital letters.
Oh, my God.
Did you know there were 9?
Oh, so is it like at the beginning of a sentence?
Yeah.
Proper nouns.
Holy.
Abbreviations. Acronyms.
Uh-huh.
There's 3.
Wow. Chemical symbols.
It's probably like
chemicals
a
in those days.
Proper, oh my god! Yeah.
So like proper nouns, proper nouns, names. If that's part of it.
Wow, we're at like 4.
Yeah. No. All right. Okay.
Capitalize the first word in a sentence. Capitalize the pronoun I and the interjection O. Like they used to say O more.
Oh.
Yeah. Capitalize the first word in a quotation. Capitalize the first word in a direct question, falling within a sentence. Capitalize all nouns referring to the deity and to the Bible and other sacred books.
Yes,
all
right.
Use a capital letter for president and presidency when these refer to the office of the president of the United States.
That's your titles.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Use a capital letter for official titles. Capitalize proper nouns and adjectives formed from proper nouns. Capitalize every word except conjunctions, articles, and short prepositions in the titles of words or works of literature, music, arts, books, etc.
Wow.
There's a lot of them.
We understand all of them. But,
yeah. They're all right. You're like, oh, yeah, that's true.
Like, oh, yeah, sure. Of course you do.
It's capital I.
Yeah.
District number 33 has a valuation of $35,000. What is the necessary levy to carry on a school 7 months at $50 per month and have $104 for incidentals?
Pass.
Yeah. I'll read their answer. I was like, oh, this is how you do valuations on school districts? Like, what?
Like, these are things any eighth grader needs to know, Dana.
Sorry.
Levy.
Yeah. The cost of 7 months of school equals $50 times 7, which is $104. Therefore, $454. Mill levy is therefore $454 minus $35,000, which equals a 0.013 levy or $1.30 per $100 valuation of the district.
Wow.
Okay, last one. Who are the following? Morse, Whitney, Fulton, Bell, Lincoln, Penn, and Howe. So first, Morse.
All right. Well,
Samuel Morse.
Samuel Morse.
Yes.
Morse code.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Inventor telegraph. Of the telegraph.
Right.
Eli Whitney.
Yes.
Cotton gin.
Oh. Fulton.
Fulton.
Is it this steam engine?
Kind of. Robert Fulton, the inventor of the first successful steam-powered paddle wheel boat.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll accept your answer, Chris. You accept mine.
Yeah, yeah. I accept Colin.
I feel like partial credit. Bell.
Alexander Graham Bell, inventor of the texting. Telephone.
And the vine.
Inventor of vines.
Lincoln.
Never heard of
no.
him.
No. Inventor of the Lincoln log.
Inventor of the stovepipe hat. Mm-hmm.
Correct. Moving on.
Oh, no.
Oh.
Oh, dark.
Too soon. How about Penn?
William Penn?
Yep.
Philadelphia in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, but what was his claim to fame?
Didn't he
found the railroad? Founded the Pennsylvania colony?
Yeah.
Okay.
The colony of Pennsylvania in 1682. How about Howe? H-O-W-E.
H-O-W-E.
Gordie Howe, obviously. Winningest hockey players.
Well known, too. 1885.
Of all time. Yeah.
I don't know.
Elias Howe, inventor of the sewing machine.
As in, how am I going to get these pieces of fabric to
together?
Stay together?
Yeah. All right. So we learned a little bit.
That was pretty cool.
We're getting closer to eighth grader from 1895. It's a long, long, hard death march to that. Like it's like doing the budget for a school district.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Done weird things.
Wheel!
Cat and Jethro Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
So last year, the Times Higher Education World Reputation Rankings released a list of what they said are the...
The best party schools?
Yeah. No, this is this may be the opposite. These are the globally recognized super brands among universities.
What do you mean super
brands? These are the best combination of reputation and prestige and academic prowess and probably, I'm sure some of it is just how famous they are.
Sure.
Harvard. So here. So there were six universities that they included in this list.
Is this within America or worldwide?
This is worldwide. However, I will give you the breakdown. Most of them, four of them are in America.
Okay.
So,
okay. All right.
So there are six universities here. Would you guys like to guess how many? I bet you guys can guess.
I guess the other two.
Okay. Well, so let's start from the top. So
all right, Harvard.
Harvard is on the list.
Yale.
Yes. Yale is not on the list.
Oh,
Stanford?
Stanford is on the list.
Berkeley.
Berkeley is on the list.
Yeah!
Go Bears!
Oxford?
Oxford is on
Cambridge.
The list. Cambridge is on the list.
Yeah. MIT.
MIT.
Yeah.
Really?
All right. Like, what are all the schools my parents used to...
So what I thought was really interesting looking at this list of six was Stanford University, California Berkeley, MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Harvard, and Oxford and Cambridge. What do you guys notice about those schools that stands out?
They're all not nice to each other.
They're all rivals. I thought that was really neat that they were three sets of just diehard collegiate university rivals. Intense rivals. Yeah. Now, to be fair, Harvard does also have the Yale rivalry, and a lot of schools have more than one rivalry.
Say within the same state.
Yeah. And they're all, you know, regionally close to each other. And so in keeping with the theme of back to school, part of coming back to school for every school year is, you know, just firing up, especially the new freshmen or the incoming students with like, these are our rivals.
You must hate them.
Oh, you know, man. I've never even heard of this other school.
It's really intense.
Yeah, it's weird.
It is intense. So I wanted to talk just a little bit about some of the crazy world of college rivalries and university rivalries. And, you know, a lot of it, for perhaps not surprising reasons, revolves around sports. Especially in America, the big thing is football. There's no doubt that college football is just the rivalry comparison for any two big schools. It's hard to beat Oxford and Cambridge for length of competition, since they've been rivals since the 1200s. Oxford and Cambridge, of course, you guys probably know, has their boat race every year, which is a big deal. It's a big deal. Down the River Thames. They've been doing this since 1829. Cambridge leads the all-time series, 81-76.
Close.
There was only one dead heat, apparently, in 1877. Too close to call. Called it a tie. Yeah. In America, it is all about football, college football. So I want to just very quickly go over some good trivia and names, because we do get these at Pub Quiz.
Yes.
You know, we'll say, what two schools compete every year for the blank trophy?
Oh, right, yeah.
These two schools have the oldest blah, blah, blah. So... So I think even if you're not a sports fan or a football fan in general, these will be some interesting things just to kind of file away. The longest running college football rivalry in America, University of Michigan and University of Notre Dame. So that is the longest running rivalry. They've been playing since 1887. This year's game set a record for the highest attendance ever at a college football game.
Wow.
115,109 people.
That's a lot of blue whales.
That is a lot. if we convert that to our standard blue whale unit.
The blue knit.
Blue knit.
We were calling them blueies, but blue knit is much better.
So University of Oregon and Oregon State University each year, their name for their game is the Civil War. You know, they all have these trumped up names to really make it important.
Wow.
They fight for the Platypus Trophy. All right, which, as it sounds like, it's a statue of a little platypus. Do you guys
taxidermy?
This is so surreal. It's a civil war for a platypus in Oregon.
It's carved. It's a statue.
Well, because one school is the ducks.
Yes, go on.
And the other school
the beavers.
Yes.
Wait, is that
true? Why it is? They fight.
Oh my goodness!
When they first commissioned a trophy between the two schools, they're like, "Let's come up with something that represents both animals."
Yeah.
So we're like, "Well, the platypus." Says the duck bill and the beaver body.
Oh,
yeah,
my goodness.
And that is what they fight for.
That's
right, now
cool.
I like it. Now
that's
I like
great.
It.
That's pretty cool.
That's really nerdy and awesome.
Yeah.
USC, University of Southern California, and Notre Dame, they fight each year for the Jeweled Shillelagh Trophy, which, as it sounds like, is a shillelagh, a big club. And each year after the victory, they'll put a new jewel on, representing...
I thought you were saying every time after the show, they hit someone with it. I was like, that is a horrible
the
tradition.
The captain of the winning team is beaten with the jeweled shillelagh.
Question, pronouncing shillelagh, right?
Shillelagh.
Shillelagh.
Shanane.
Shillelagh.
The jeweled shillelagh.
Yeah.
Yes. And each year they stud it with a new decoration.
Wow. Mm.
Yeah. It's a
blingy.
Yeah. Bedazzled.
It is an amazingly bedazzled phallic trophy. Possibly the most phallic of all the trophies given out.
I just think about
jewel
that.
And again, just to drive the point home, if you're not a fan of the college sport rivalries, the deal with these things is that the winning school gets to keep it that
year. For a year.
Yeah. And you put it on display in your trophy case.
Yep.
Stanford and Berkeley, Cal Berkeley, do you guys remember what we fight for?
Right?
The axe.
Oh.
It's the Stanford axe, which is, that one goes back to an old pep rally, basically, at Stanford in 1899, where they were using it to decapitate, like, a straw man representing the Cal students, the Berkeley students. So,
they take it so far, you guys. Like, the Berkeley Stanford one, we went to those schools, like, it is crazy.
They set this on fire.
really intense.
They would make piñatas of people. I don't know.
Every time you say the name, you have to hiss.
I still do that.
SMU, Southern Methodist University, and TCU, Texas Christian, they fight for the iron skillet. And it is an actual iron skillet. It's not some oversized, golden. It's
like a normal skillet.
It's an iron
skillet.
That's
awesome.
Make victory breakfast.
Yeah.
Victory bacon.
Okay. Well, so the TCU mascot is the Horned Frogs, all right? The Texas Christian Horned Frogs.
Wait, what are they going to do with the skillet?
Well, the story goes back to a game in the 40s that an SMU fan, I guess, was, before the game, was frying up some frogs' legs in the skillet.
That's
kind
cute.
Of like, we're going to get you. The University of Louisville and University of Cincinnati. This one might be my favorite just because it's the most absurd.
It's an empty can of Nair. The empty can of Nair.
They fight for the keg of nails.
Oh,
you're so close.
Yeah, I know. Really, really close.
Wow.
Is it really a keg of...
It's a replica now. It's a replica now.
Because it couldn't get
seven
a real...
They actually... Every year someone had to jump in the keg of nails.
Oh my god.
The captain of the losing team.
That's where they keep the victory beer, in the keg of nails.
Yes. Once upon a time, it was in fact a keg of nails. Symbolizing the players are tough as nails.
Yeah.
And so those are just some of the fun rivalry game names and trophy names that I came into doing my research.
Almost time for the final bell for our school episode, and I'm going to end it with a quiz about lots of movies have been made about prep schools, about boarding schools. Here I have a pretty varied quiz, some questions about movies that take place or is about boarding schools or prep schools. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a quick one-line summary and buzz in and tell me the full title of the movie.
Okay.
Okay. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone.
They're all Harry Potter.
Yeah, it's about seven movies.
They're varied.
I hate all of them. All right.
We know you, Karen.
That's our show, everyone.
Okay, well, right. Let's get this out of the way.
Okay, all right.
Kenneth Branagh plays charming but useless Professor Gilderoy Lockhart in this boarding school movie.
Yeah.
Full title, please.
Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets.
Correct.
Who is Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets?
All right. This movie, set in the fictional Welton Academy, featured two very famous movie quotes, "O Captain, My Captain," and "Carpe Diem." Mm. Chris?
The Dead Poets Society?
Correct. Yeah. Brendan Fraser plays a Jewish high schooler who hides his religion to fit in with his posh prep school friends.
Was this School Ties?
It is School Ties.
Oh, yeah.
Very young Matt Damon and Ben Affleck.
This is not a wacky comedy movie.
No, this is serious
drama.
Yeah.
Okay.
School Ties. This British film franchise is based on a cartoon that started in the 1940s about a chaotic and uncontrollable all-girls prep school. British listeners will definitely get this one. And Dana.
Guess. St. Trinian's.
Correct. Yeah. St. Trinian's.
I like your, yeah, British listeners and Dana. Yeah.
After winning the Junior Goodwill Games as Team USA, a band of eccentric but athletic kids try to adjust to prep school life as the new junior varsity team. Dana, full title, please.
Is this Mighty Ducks 2?
Incorrect.
Something? Am I on the right track?
Yes.
Yeah.
It is D3: The Mighty Ducks.
Oh, sorry. Wow.
Which is... Yeah. When this movie came out, it was kind of weird, but I was like, didn't they just win, like, at Team USA?
Yeah, they did.
And now they're in this JV team for a school. All right. This coming-of-age movie starring Chris O'Donnell is so good it makes you want to say, hooah!
Scent of a Woman.
Yes, yeah. Scent of a Woman. Very awesome Al Pacino. Argon. And a very young Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Ah.
He was also in that movie.
Although he still looked 50.
All right. Chronologically young.
And last one. Charles and Eric started an academy to help train special young kids to develop their extraordinary talents. Oh. Colin's excited.
The X-Men universe.
X-Men House.
Correct. X-Men House.
X-Men First Class.
Yes.
Okay.
Good job, everybody. And that is our show all about school stuff. Thank you guys for joining me, and thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned a lot. Oh, man, learned a lot about pencils, about Oregon Trail, about teachers, about Freshman 15, a whole bunch of stuff. And you can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, and also on our website, goodjobbrain.com. And also join us on Facebook and Twitter. And thanks to our sponsor for this episode, Audible. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye. Bye.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.